Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, everybody.
Hi, guys. Happy Memorial Day weekend. Memorial Day.
Happy Memorial Day.
Cheers.
Yes, cheers. Cheers to everybody. Hope that you all have had a relaxing weekend, and we give a big thank you to all of our veterans, of course.
Yes. Those currently active, those have given the ultimate sacrifice. We both have family members who have been in the service and friends that are currently in the service or have been, so we thank you.
Yes, cheers to you all. And for everybody who's tuning in with us this evening, thanks for joining us for...
I've lost count, 10?
Something like 10.
I think it's 10.
We think we're at 10 now, but yeah, 10 weeks of, I don't know, maybe...
I need a change of scenery. I need a beach.
A beach?
How many of you need a beach with me?
And yes.
That's in Florida, and yes. I'm decorated to my beach with
yes.
my...
And I'm barefoot, ready to go for a walk on the beach myself. And we got our beachfront drinks. We got
Dark and Stormies.
I got introduced to these in Key West a few years ago, and we've never looked back. So...
So definitely Dark and Stormy. Ginger beer, rum, lime. All you need into mice.
Rum, of course.
Lots of rum. As you can see, the rum is... Up top.
Yep. And, I'm starting to look like I was marooned on a desert beach for a while now at this point.
He's starting to get the pirates and black sails to run for the scrubbing.
Yeah, I got a ways to go for that, but...
I'm definitely up there. I'm like, should I just chop it all off? I'm tempted to.
Making decisions. We'll see when we get there.
Yeah. I do have an appointment at the end of June, so I might be short when you see me in July. Anyway, so we're going to talk about haunted beaches. And thanks for everybody who's joined us so far. We're going to stick to the East Coast, the South Carolina, up to Maryland is where we're going to kind of focus our area.
We didn't have... Oh, no. Maine was another one. No, another show.
Yes.
We'll be visiting Maine with some stories.
I think we're just going to do Maine stories one time.
Yeah, we got lots of stories.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. We got all kinds of people checking in with us. Oh, wow.
Oh, great.
Okay, so, yeah. So... Trina, hello. Yes, 10,000 and a half certainly feels that way. Yes, bring on the beach. We are all... Allison, hi, Allison.
Yes, I have actually seen friends saying, I've got my dates booked for the Outer Banks. So I'm like...
Yeah, hope thanks for checking in with us. And Mark, yeah, happy Memorial Day back at you. And Alex, for you as well. And yes, the beach does sound wonderful. So.
Yes. So let's start down at one of the most famous beach stories in South Carolina, Polly's Island and the Gray Man. This is one that was brought up at our very first show. Somebody had asked if we had heard about it, and yes, we have. So we decided we would start with that one. Polly's Island, for those of you who don't know where it is, again, it's in South Carolina. It's one of the oldest summer resort towns on the East Coast. It's just 35 minutes south of Myrtle Beach area. We have never been.
No, we have not been.
It would be someplace for us to check out. I wouldn't mind. I don't mind going up and down those little barrier islands, North Carolina, South Carolina. I would love to go to any of them right now.
Oh, island hopping.
Yeah. Different version, but I'll take it.
I'll get that.
This one is very, very well-versed folklore and legend, all ghost story, all combined into one. And it's not one who anybody really truly knows the origin story. There's actually, I think, four or five different possible origin stories that one of the local museums has discovered on it. So we'll get into that afterward. But the most recent appearance of the Gray Man actually was right before Hurricane Florence in 2018. As the hurricane approached, governors of North and South Carolina issued their mandatory evacuation order. And it was at that point in time that people started whispering the Gray Man has been seen. And if you know anything about the Gray Man, if he is seen, you get your butt out of there. You pack it up and you leave. So one of the residents of Polly's Island saw the so-called Gray Man. Says this is not a boogeyman meant to scare children. He is selfless. He is purposeful. He saves lives. So everybody in the Lowcountry has heard when the hurricanes and tropical storms begin to form around the area, people will start asking, have you seen him? Have you seen him? Is he out there? And he's pretty friendly. He walks up and down the beach. He's always wearing sort of a gray rain slicker, an older style coat, which kind of throws people off and makes people kind of go, hmm. But again, once you acknowledge him, once you wave to him, that's when he tends to disappear. And they say if you do see him, you pack up and you leave immediately, your property is safe. You come back, everybody else's property around you could be harmed, but yours is safe. So the reported scene in 2018 was actually by a group of five people walking on the beach. They said they saw the gray man. They waved to him, thinking he was another resident. He didn't wave back. He disappeared. And this was on September 9th of 2018. The hurricane hit pretty short after that. Anybody they saw after that said, we've seen the gray man, pack it up, leave. They started warning everybody they possibly could. They went to the local grocery store and local hangouts and warned them. So they actually started, I guess, the gossip chain is the best way to say it. And people started packing up and leaving. According to other people, he's dressed like a pirate, some people say. Kind of floats without legs. Kind of weird. But over the past 200 years, five hurricanes have hit the shores of Pawleys Island, most notably Hurricane Hazel in 1954, and, of course, Hurricane Hugo in 1989. Hazel caused 95 fatalities, and Hugo caused 21 fatalities. And the gray man appeared between before both of those storms. One woman in 1954 claimed to see the gray man ahead of Hazel. She not only left her house with everything, but she actually left it in such a hurry. She left her beach towel up on the railings, drying, and they were still there when she returned to her house. Again, her neighbor's houses had all been wrecked, but hers was fine, and the towels were still on the railing. So that just shows you how much protection he puts on a place when he warns you. As I mentioned, there are a couple of different ideas of who the gray man is. The Georgetown Museum has actually several origin story possibilities. The first one and the most popular one is that the gray man was a man who was in love. He fell victim to a major storm that struck on September 27th at 1822 and made landfall near Charleston. He was possibly a sailor who had been aboard for 2 years, was eager to get back and see his fiancée so they could set a wedding date and finally get married. He was on his way to see her when the storm struck, and unfortunately, he drove himself and a horse into a pool of quicksand and lost his life there during that storm. News got up to the fiancée that he had passed on, and she was so grief-stricken that she actually went out on the beach crying her eyes out, as any fiancé would do at that point in time, and she saw him. He walked towards her, and then she recognized him, and he disappeared in front of her eyes. She went home, and she bawled her eyes out, laid on her bed, basically made herself sick, and that night during her dreams, he came to her again, and she was just so overwrought and so distressed with the family. Packed up everything, and they left the island the next day, supposedly to seek a doctor for her. A hurricane hit the very next day. Her property was saved. All the neighbors were wrecked. So she was the first survival victim of the warning.
Yep, first one to survive a gray man warning.
So again, that was in 1822.
Been going almost 200 years now.
Yep. The second one still has a man coming back from sea. But this time, his fiancé, instead of waiting for him, has actually married his best friend instead. He throws himself into the Waccamaw, and later the fiancé and the friend do the same. I don't think that's in our gray man.
It doesn't sound like it.
It seems a little too tragic. The third possibility sees an unknown sailor who washes up on shore on Pawleys Island and dies shortly thereafter. That one's, again, very vague. And the fourth one is that they believe he might be the original owner of Pawleys Island, George Pawley, who lived there in the early 1700s, and that he loves his island so much that he will actually try to protect some of those who still live there. So I think our two likely suspects are either George or the fiancé.
Yeah. Both of those make sense.
Yeah.
But anything's possible.
It is. Now, the Georgetown Museum's their very first recorded sighting of the gray man and a property being saved was actually in 1893. They say a family saw the gray man and again, theirs is the only home in the neighborhood that survived. So that's their first recorded sighting of him. So he's been around for quite a while. He first appeared in print in 1956 in the book of ghost stories by Julian Stevens Bullock. And he got international attention when he appeared on the Unsolved Mysteries show. So that's how he's gotten quite so infamous.
Yep, people know him everywhere now. And he's actually, they made mention of him on some mainstream news stories
as
well.
Oh, yeah. That's one of the first things when we moved down here and Hurricane Florence was coming through. Everybody started speculating on the news stations coming out of North Carolina and South Carolina. Has anybody seen the Gray Man? I was like, the Gray Man? What? And I started looking him up. So that's how I first learned about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's also a Gray Man that appears in Hatteras as well. And we don't know if it's the same one or a similar one. But same story. You see him, and he will tell you, this one will actually speak to you and tell you to pack it up. He will tell you to pack it in and leave. And again, those who follow his warning, their property survives. So.
Yeah. Listen to the Gray Man.
Yeah. All right, so we're going to jump over to St. Helena Island.
Yes.
I'm going to let you take
over
a second drink.
So we're going to go for a nice trip down the coast. So St. Helena Island, one of the sea islands. It's on a chain of barrier islands, again, along the South Carolina coast, and it's located in the Port Royal Sound. So the mystery of the island is the land and light, which is seen when traveling along the lower tip of the island known as, well, Land's End, aptly named. Driving past the hanging tree where runaway slaves were hung, drivers are advised to park their cars and turn off their headlights. So what happens next is that a single headlight will appear, and it appears to be traveling down the road. Eyewitnesses claim that when the light passes, it leaves a static electrical charge in its wake. Some people have reported that the light overtook them while they were speeding away from it. And the island was a hot spot in the 1970s, with the Sheriff's Department reporting that many nights there were at least 100 cars parked waiting to see the light. Two people have died when they attempted to chase the light and crashed. Scientists have studied the light but have no explanation for the phenomenon that appears on a regular basis. This sounds very similar to a certain train light that we talked about on the show a few weeks ago.
Yes, the ghost light down near West Point?
Yes.
Yep.
So you got the light, mysterious light travels. In that case, it traveled on the train tracks, but you've got a similar one here traveling down a road down there on St. Helena Island. So, drew quite the commotion. Apparently, chasing ghostly lights was a thing to do in the 70s, because I think
that's when it was very popular at West Point.
Yeah, that's where it peaked out down there as well. excuse me. So, there are other paranormal occurrences down there. South Carolina's Information Highway reports that the light is a soft white light floating several feet above the ground. It also warns that the motorists that attempt to start a that if a motorist attempts to start a car to try and chase after it, that the light will just suddenly vanish. The light is not very keen on trying to be pursued. Writer Barry Gooch recounts how one night he was parked underneath the hanging tree with his girlfriend and they witnessed the phenomenon. The couple watched as the orb of light slowed down and drifted over to their car. Terrified, they sat in a trance as the orb hovered over the right side fender of the car. Gooch started the car and the orb vanished as it is known to do.
Okay, that makes me feel like a UFO.
Yeah, well, you mentioned that. There's many stories about what the light could possibly be. People think that it's the ghost of children who died in a bus crash in that area, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Bad bus crash. Sadly, lots of kids died, and they think that it may be the spirits of the kids. Also, of course, we mentioned the hanging tree and how back in the pre-Civil War era, escaped slaves were sometimes or oftentimes hung from this hanging tree that's still down there to the day. Some people think it's the ghosts of those hung slaves. And then there's that of a spirit of a Union officer who was beheaded during the Civil War. Not a good way to go.
No.
Don't know the details of that story.
And if you think about it, when we've been in Savannah by the hanging tree, there's been a lot of light orb activity there as well. So it could be something with the history of the hanging tree.
Yeah.
But very interesting.
lots of possibilities in that area.
Oh, yeah.
And lots of parallels as well. As I said, we got our own parallel right back up here in Virginia.
Yeah. Ghost train. And at Devon, it was actually considered a union. Was it a union ghost train or was it Confederate? A lost train.
Confederate. Yeah. The Confederate ghost train supposedly left Richmond on its way, was it on its way to West Point, I think?
Mm-hmm.
And it supposedly never arrived. So that's what they think the ghost light of the on the railroad tracks in West Point, Virginia is.
Yeah. All right, so let's bounce north.
And we're going to talk about some a lot of people's very most favorite ghost of all.
This is why I'm wearing this.
Yeah.
Here we go.
We are moving up to Ocracoke Island. Of course, that's down the far end of North Carolina's Outer Banks.
Yes, which we have been to. We actually love Ocracoke. That's our favorite place in the Outer Banks to go and stay.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about Blackbeard.
Yes.
Edward Teach.
Of course.
Because
Ocracoke.
Yeah, and that was Teach's Island.
Yes.
That was his favorite place to camp and unload and bury treasure and had his own kind of plantation.
Yeah, a little sheltered area in there. Sheltered area, it was called Silver Lake or also known as Teach's Hole. Edward Teach, everybody knows him as Blackbeard more commonly, is undoubtedly one of the most notorious and ruthless pirates of all time.
Okay, when a guy puts burning wire in his beard to make things even scarier, he's badass.
Yeah, lots of smoke, lots of very vicious activity, boarding ships and the like. He was a force to be reckoned with.
He was. Very cool pirate. Don't believe what you see on Black Sails, by the way, about him, because they completely butchered him down.
They butchered a lot on Black Sails. Very entertaining show, but
not the truth.
No.
But let's get to the truth that teaches death.
Blackbeard was, as we mentioned, a very fierce adversary, and he stood about 6'5".
He was a huge man.
Very dramatic presentation to himself. And he finally got, the governor of Virginia fed up with Blackbeard's antics. Sent John Maynard to hunt down and kill Blackbeard, and surprisingly so, John Maynard, he was very successful.
Surprising.
So he managed to catch up with Blackbeard, and there's the story of Blackbeard getting stabbed and shot countless times before what they finally managed to do. They beheaded him, and they brought the head back as evidence, but they tossed the body overboard.
So Blackbeard's still looking for his head. It's actually recorded that his body swam around the ship 3 times.
Yes, before sinking.
It says the head screamed the entire time that the body was swimming. Screaming, beheaded head. I'm just going to leave it there.
Blackbeard built quite the legend for himself. Swimming around the boat several times before. Since that execution, since he was hunted down in 1718, there have been many tourists and locals that have reported seeing the headless body swimming around Teach's Hole, and there have also been reports of a headless Blackbeard wandering the beaches of Ocracoke Island, searching for his lost head while holding a lantern.
I don't want to meet him, headless or not. He was very mean.
Was he though? Was he really? I'll let you
know. I was going to say, I'm a female. He won't have much respect for me.
Yeah, he got married how many times?
14.
A lot.
Yeah.
Never officially really divorced. He just up and left.
That's another story for another time.
Yeah.
Okay.
The history. So, yes, Blackbeard does still haunt Ocracoke Island down there in the Outer Banks.
All right, so let's jump up to the main island of the Outer Banks. And we're going to jump through like Kitty Hawk, Hatteras, and Corolla. So let's start in Corolla. Another place I'd love to go is the local lighthouse there, and I want to see the horses. I'd get to see the horses on the beach.
Yep.
But I have seen them down in Oklahoma.
So once you go up to Corolla, there is a particular location located at 1100 Club Road. Now, just based on the name alone, you probably can tell that this place is going to be a little ritzy. It's a 21,000-square-foot mansion overlooking the Currituck Sound, and it was originally built by Edward and Marie Knight as a hunting retreat in 1925.
Hunting retreat on an island.
21,000 square feet.
They moved in.
Hunting lodge.
Year-round for a while.
Yeah. So the building was revered for its historic Art Nouveau style architecture, and in the 1990s, the building was restored to its original condition after having been used for a variety of purposes over the years, including a Coast Guard shelter, a boys' correctional school, and a rocket fuel testing site. That's quite the resume for this building. For two decades, it even sat abandoned. Today it is home to the Whalehead Club, and it is open to visitors, but despite its beauty and architectural value, many people feel that there is something eerie about this building. Numerous visitors have claimed to smell cigar smoke near the portrait of Edward Knight, a man very well known for enjoying his cigars. Another witness claimed that someone grabbed his leg when he was walking on the second floor all by himself. Once, a young child even ran from the house after claiming a little girl tried to grab him in the basement despite no adults seeing anyone else around. Other reports of strange activity are pots and pans banging together and an empty kitchen, and doors slamming shut on their own. Reports of paranormal activity at the building are so common that paranormal research professionals have conducted investigations in the home, several confirming the basement seems to be a hotbed of activity.
I wonder if we can get our friends at Transcend to go for a trip.
If they're paying attention, I'm willing to bet somebody would jump in and say they're all for it.
Oh, yeah, because most of them are wanting to go to the beach right now, especially the Outer Banks. So.
I think a 21,000-square-foot beach retreat would provide plenty of social distancing for us all to go down there and each have our own spaces.
I agree, especially the basement.
Yeah. But you can stay in the basement.
Well, I mean, if it's like any of my other ghostly basement experiences, I'll be attacked. Basements and I don't get along with ghostly things.
Yeah,
I get bruised.
Being one of penthouses upstairs or whatever it is.
I'll take the room. I'll go stay in their room and deal with the cigar smoke. I'm allergic to. So, all right. So we're going to drop down to another one of my favorite characters in Mag's Head, and this is the disappearance of Theodosia Burr, Aaron Burr's daughter. And those of you that remember your history or love a certain musical on Broadway right now, Hamilton, you'll know that Aaron Burr was our vice president at one point in time, and he is the man who shot Hamilton. He had one daughter, and that is Theodosia Burr, named after her mother, Theodosia. She has a very, very sad tale, and it's a tale of mystery, art, and a ghostly apparition. The woman in question, as I said, is Theodosia Burr Elston. She is the daughter of Aaron Burr. Again, both for money and marriage. She was wealthy. She was said to have been very intelligent and cultured. Many actually wondered if Aaron fell in love with his daughter the same way he fell in love with her mother. But that's another one of those mysteries. But they were very devoted to each other. She suffered various illnesses and depression, causing her to withdraw from a normal social life, especially after she lost her child. In December of 1812, she planned to pay a visit to her beloved father in New York via the schooner Patriot, which was departing from Georgetown, South Carolina. Unfortunately, she never arrived in New York. Many theories exist as to what happened to the Patriot, ranging from being an unfortunate casualty of the War of 1812 or the schooner running aground on the Diamond Shoal. Whichever it was, she was never seen again. Or was she? So some people actually believe a legend that she may have survived whatever happened at sea and found herself on Mag's Head. An elderly couple actually recorded stumbling upon a woman in a white gown clinging to a large portrait. Confused and unable to express what happened to her or who she was, the woman was taken by the couple into their house and cared for her. At one point, she became so ill that the couple requested a house call from an out-of-town doctor. Unfortunately, they were not able to pay for the visit, but they offered the doctor the portrait the woman had been clinging to instead. They knew he was a collector of fine arts and would recognize its value. He accepted this deal. The sick woman suddenly jumped up, claimed the portrait as her own, and ran out to the sea where she was never seen again. The next day, the portrait washed back up on shore. Another account tells how a wrecker, Joseph Tillett, found the portrait while scavenging a ship that had washed up on the Outer Banks coast. Although there are variations of the folklore as to who first discovered the painting, it eventually got obtained by Dr. William Poole in 1869. He reached out to several members of the Burr and Alston family in an effort to confirm that this was indeed Theodosia's portrait. As many believe that the discovery of this painting confirms one way or another, she was lost at sea. Today, the portrait is hanging in the Lewis Walpole Library at Yale University.
Not sure how it got up to Yale, but all the same.
Considering her father was grandfather. No, he was Princeton.
No, that's right. That's right, Princeton.
The fact that her portrait from Yale and he was Princeton?
Yeah.
Ooh, that's not good. But maybe there's an Alston connection.
Could be.
To Yale.
I derailed you.
Yes, you did. Anyway, Black Pelican. We're going to go to Kitty Hawk. Black Pelican is a very popular restaurant. We have not been there. I wanted to go the last time we were there, but we didn't get a chance to.
No, next time.
Next time. But one of our guys has been there. In fact, she goes to the Black Pelican restaurant every time she goes down to Nagpet.
Marcia. Our guide, Marcia.
Yes.
Love Black Pelican. And was very surprised when we told her the story.
Yeah, when I read the story, I texted her, I'm like, hey, did you know that there's a blood stain and a ghost in the Black Pelican? She goes, what?
And the folklore behind the name of Black Pelican.
Yeah, so it's an interesting combination, the building and the name. So let's start with the building. The building actually was the original Kitty Hawk life-saving station. It's considered unrecognizable now. As the restaurant, but there's still some of the gingerbread work on it that you can tell it was part of the old life-saving station. And they do have pictures, photos, and articles that show that history inside.
Nods to the past. Has a few of those architectural details and nods to its historical past.
Yeah. So in the mid-1800s, with the increase of maritime traffic along the East Coast, everybody decided we needed to have a life-saving station in the Outer Banks and specifically at Kitty Hawk. So by 1874, a number of the stations were constructed along the islands, including Kitty Hawk. It was usually run by a crew of 7 men, a keeper, usually referred to as the captain, and 6 men underneath him that worked to run the boats, do the drills, all those things. They were usually mariners, sailors, and fishermen. W.D. Tate was the first keeper, and he was replaced a few years later by a man named James R. Hobbs. Like all keepers, Hobbs worked the crew 6 days a week, drilling them, keeping them sharp and prepared. They were practicing launching their boat from the beach through the crashing breakers in all kinds of weather. They patrolled the beach up to 5 miles on foot and stood for hours in the lookout tower. Chairs were forbidden because he didn't want his men falling asleep. They also practiced signaling and first aid. The Kitty Hawk station was on a long stretch of open sandy shoreline. The isolation here was no different than that along a sort of a calm sailing ship at sea. The crew worked together. They lived together on the confines of the station, and the isolation may have gotten them on each other's nerves. So,
I can't imagine that.
Yeah. Anybody else get on anybody's nerves around here? Our cat. She's right over here judging us, by the way.
All is well in the Houlihan household.
It's just the cat. She's ready for us to be gone. She's so ready for us to be gone. Anyway.
Only after we give her what she wants to eat. Another story.
Anyway,
another day.
It's been a day with the cat. So back to our life-saving station and our Captain Hobbs. There was another gentleman there on his team. Some people think he might have been local, but other people claim he was actually on the team. And this was Theophilus Daniels. And he really just hated Hobbs. He wanted Hobbs' job, and he had it out for Hobbs. So eventually, the way he figured out to get rid of Hobbs was to accuse Hobbs of using government-issued paint on his private vessel, which he wasn't doing.
Petty.
But that's what the accusation was.
Talk about being petty.
Yeah. And he also claimed that Hobbs was forcing his crew to upkeep his personal property, which, again, he wasn't doing, but that's the claim that was made. So, according to the government record, they sent down an investigator to basically listen to both sides of the story because it literally was one man's word versus the other man's word, and he had to sort this out. Now, Hobbs, after he received word that an investigator was coming down, sent his own telegram saying, okay, this is the one I have been dealing with. This is the shit he has been doing. It includes greeting him with unfiltered profanities, vulgarities, and insult, and it is even said that Daniels insulted Hobbs' wife by spitting tobacco juice on her dress. Hobson had enough. So he figured this investigation was a way to get rid of Daniels for good. So down comes the investigator, and they are both sitting inside the life-saving station, and Daniels was giving his testimony and accusing Hobbs, who's sitting socially distanced across from him, and the rest of the men behind.
Socially distanced so they couldn't strangle each other on the spot.
And Daniels realizes this is not going in his favor, so he starts to reach into his pocket. Hobbs realizes Daniels brought a pistol with him, and Daniels intends to kill him no matter what. So he turns around, stands up, grabs the shotgun because the pistol's actually gotten caught on his pants, so he can't pull it out all the way. This gave Hobbs enough time to grab the pistol, unload one shot into him, at which point the pistol came out. It was fired, missing Hobbs completely. The second shotgun was fired into Daniels, and Daniels dies in the life saving station.
Yeah. A couple shotgun blasts would probably do anybody in.
Yeah.
Hard to feel sorry for the guy.
Yep.
And I don't think anybody that worked with him felt particularly sorry for him either, because even though they were on dry land, they weren't very ceremonious about his burial.
No, they dumped him out in the ocean.
They threw him in the ocean. Burial at sea.
Yep. Now, Hobbs, of course, was investigated for killing one of his crew members, but he was found not guilty. It was deemed self-defense.
Self-defense. Which was legit.
Yep.
Daniels brought a gun and was so slow on the draw. It's hard to feel sorry for the guy on any level.
Yeah. Now, the life-saving station is
So, clarify, who was falsely accusing who again? Daniels falsely accused Hobbs of using government property improperly. Investigator comes down, testimony is taken from both sides. Daniel hates Hobbs badly enough to bring a pistol there because he figures that even if Hobbs is acquitted, he's going to go ahead and shoot him anyway. Things are not going in his favor. Daniels goes for the pistol. Hobbs goes for the shotgun that's on the wall, gets to the shotgun first, and unloads two rounds into Daniels, killing him on the spot.
Yeah. That's the brief summary.
Cliff Notes version.
Cliff Notes version. So the life-saving station has been moved twice to protect it from falling into the ocean to where it's currently located. The hauntings that happen there, it is said that Daniels is a restless spirit. He is said to bang around the inside of the old station house, down the restaurant where he was killed. Workers in the restaurant report mysterious noises and shadowy figures lurking around. So prominent are these reports that the restaurant is listed as one of the most spooky haunts of the Outer Banks. Hostess Paula Midget will not go upstairs after dark in the Black Pelican on Halloween or any other time. She has actually seen an apparition in the corner of the dining area after closing one night, and she said it is most definitely Daniel. He was sitting as if he has a grudge, and behind him, the walls were bleeding. Yeah.
What? Bleeding walls?
Bleeding walls.
Well, Amityville Horror.
Few investigators, you know. There's a permanent reminder of Daniel in the form of a blood stain that is actually right as you walk in near the hostess area, between the hostess area and the door. And it's permanent. They can't get rid of it. There's also
if anybody can verify that, we'd love to.
I would love to see a picture.
We haven't seen any pictures of it, and our guide, Marcia, who's been there many times, says she's never noticed it, but then again, she's more focused on getting something to eat.
Yeah, she's not staring at the floor when she walks in.
Yes.
Several customers have actually heard footsteps and closing doors. It's very scary at night. A little boy actually went into the bathroom and began screaming that he had seen a ghost. No one could find signs of it. There's a reoccurring cold or distressing spot that is felt in the area of the bathroom and the stairway. That sounds familiar here, too.
Yeah. That happens down at our old Julep's location at 18th and Franklin here in Shaco Bottom.
Literally right outside a bathroom where a stairwell used to be.
Yep. Very, very similar.
Yep.
You look at enough ghost stories, you start seeing some parallels.
Oh, yeah. So now we mentioned that there was a legend of the name, the Black Pelican, as well.
You need to have something to drink.
Okay, go for it.
Yeah.
I'll drink.
Yeah. You need to have something to drink. So,
yeah,
the Black Pelican, the name for the Black Pelican, did not come out of nowhere. It's actually based on this legend where serving at one of these remote, lonely outposts for these early, the Coast Guard folks,
the lifesavers,
was most likely at times quite boring, as you might imagine. And if you want some good, a good example of that, there's a movie out, kind of a little loopy, a little crazy right now, starring William Dafoe and Robert Pattinson.
It will mess you up. Called
The Lighthouse. Completely messed up. But yeah, it can kind of show how that sort of isolation can get to your head.
Yeah.
Now, from the vantage point of somebody at this lookout tower, men scan the horizon for any sign of a ship in distress. Often the gaze of the lookout spied the familiar shape of a lone pelican gliding above the mist of the ocean spray. This pelican was different, however. It was not the colors of a typical brown pelican, as it was completely black, almost the color of coal. It soon became apparent that the appearance of this bird was followed by incidents of bad weather or ships in need. So, you got a little bit of a precursor story going on here, similar to the great man. You have another warning. So, when the winds whipped the sea into a frothy foam and storm clouds obscured the vision of the lookout, the Black Pelican appeared. This was a signal for the storm warriors to prepare their equipment. It is said that the bird often guided the boat crew through the waves, locating wrecked boats and survivors to be rescued. If you think this is just a myth, station keeper Tate also mentioned the Black Pelican, which he referred to as a watchdog in his journal.
Remember, Tate was the first keeper.
Yes. Yep. So first keeper, he actually made note of it in his official journal. Survivors of shipwrecks also note in their diaries that the pelican glided just above the surface of the water and soared above, giving them the hope of rescue in a dreadful situation. Throughout the history of the station, crewmen reported the resolution of the Black Pelican to assist in rescues or to warn of dreadful weather. In 1915, the life-saving service merged into what is now the U.S. Coast Guard. Eventually, many of the life-saving stations were shuttered and abandoned, and sightings of the Black Pelican became less and less frequent. Today, boaters along the Outer Banks continue to report a Black Pelican when the weather is at its worst. Perhaps the soot-colored savior bird was merely a wayward, magnificent bird soaring the ocean skies. Maybe it was just a brown pelican with a rare melanistic color variation causing it to be all black. Either way, it doesn't matter. For those in need, it was a guardian angel masquerading as a pelican. So that's
fun little legend for
fun
you.
Fun legend, the legend of the Black Pelican and how the restaurant that's there now got its name.
Yep. All right, so we're going to bounce up to Georgia.
Down to Georgia.
Down to Georgia. Sorry, I thought I put these in order.
You're always going down to Georgia. Everything goes down to Georgia. Even if you're in Florida, remember the devil went down to Georgia.
And, yeah, and he played a fiddle.
Yeah. And that's how the song goes, even if you're in Florida or anywhere.
Yep. Okay.
You go down
so
to
we're going down to Georgia.
Down to Georgia. Specifically to Tybee Island.
Which we have been to.
Yes. Yeah, Tybee Island, really cool place.
Yeah, if you have not gone, it is well worth it. It's a day drive, less than a day drive.
Oh, like, it's like 20, 30 minutes
outside
Savannah.
Yeah, it's like a day trip to Savannah. You can hit several forts along the way. There's like three forts, including the one that's literally right outside the lighthouse that we're going to talk to.
Yes.
Talk about it.
Talking to a lighthouse?
I need more drink.
Yes, you do. That's why I told you. So, Tybee Lighthouse Station. Tybee's Island Lighthouse is the oldest and tallest structure, lighthouse in Georgia.
Okay.
I need to make myself another.
Okay.
All right. In fact, it's one of the most intact historic lighthouses remaining in all of America to this day. In 1732, General James Oglethorpe, if you have ever been to Savannah, you know that
Oglethorpe is everywhere.
It is everywhere. Very features very prominently into
There's
the Oglethorpe
Road.
And square. Yes. And so Oglethorpe ordered the construction of the lighthouse tower. The building's development was completed in 1736, but it was felled by a storm in 1741. The tower was rebuilt the following year by a man named Thomas Sumner. This time around, though, workers used stone and wood. The lighthouse tower was not illuminated either time. Rather, the structure sported a very tall flagpole instead. So not really a lighthouse, more of a signal tower type thing. But anyways, After the second lighthouse was swept away by encroaching tides and erosion.
By the way, there's four that have been in the site.
Yes, a third tower was erected in its place in 1773 by John Mulryne. Made of sturdy bricks and wooden stairs and landings, this base remains intact within the current lighthouse. So, hey, there's some evidence of this building still there. In 1790, Georgia ratified the U.S. Constitution and yielded the lighthouse to the federal government. The lighthouse was then fitted with reflectors and candles, but soon was upgraded to oil lamps. Very cutting-edge technology for the time. In order to form a navigation range for ships entering the narrow Savannah River, a second tower was added approximately 1,000 feet from the current site in 1822. Now, in 1857, both towers received Fresnel lenses. Now, if you know anything about lighthouses, Fresnel lenses were, I mean,
these were state-of-the-art.
State-of-the-art. They're still very highly regarded today. They came in multiple magnitudes, multiple orders, and the higher the order, the further the light could project. Yeah. I mean, we're talking like almost...
And they're beautiful.
Yeah.
Like that. They are works of art.
Yes. So during the Civil War, Confederate forces burned the lighthouse, but removed the precious lenses, which they retreated to Fort Pulaski. The fourth establishment of the Tybee Island Lighthouse began in 1866, right after the Civil War ended, but was delayed when a cholera outbreak struck the area. When the new tower was finally finished, it was built upon the first 60 feet of the pre-existing tower. This elevated the finished height to its current height of 154 feet, and the tower was equipped with a larger Fresnel lens. But as luck would have it, the lighthouse was severely impacted by a hurricane in 1871. The next keeper's dwelling were installed on the lighthouse 5-acre grounds, and in 1933, the tower was fitted with electricity, and the lighthouse reduced their staff to a single lightkeeper. Nothing to make somebody go a little crazy by stationing them out there all by themselves.
Just saying. Even with your family.
So, and then eventually, as many lighthouses were, it was automated in 1972, and nobody needed to live there anymore.
It is a fantastic place to go and see because they still have the keeper, both keeper houses. They have the lighthouse. The grounds are beautiful. They're working to restore, but, of course, funding is always an issue. So definitely, if you get a chance to go and check it out. Climb the lighthouse. It's 172 stairs, I think.
Something like that.
All I know is
it's a decent climb.
In August when we did it, I was suffering from heat stroke when I came back down. And I just petted the cat after that because there's a couple of cats on site and they're fun and they're playful. And
they just chill out there.
They do. And it was a great place to just let me drink water and pet the cat and I'll be fine.
Yeah. So obviously the site has tons of history. It's been there for a very long time. And, well, as many things that have a very long and sometimes tumultuous history, occasionally
they're going to have a ghost.
You're going to have a ghost. And this is no exception. Do you want to take over?
Yeah, sure. So the apparition that is often seen is the a man in the first assistant keeper house. There's a lot of constant footsteps heard in there, and especially in the kitchen they're heard. And there's also knocking heard in the kitchen when people are touring the keeper's house. The head keeper's house has a claim of hearing whistling and hearing the front door trying to be opened and closed. A psychic actually has seen the spirits of two children playing in the yard, jumping rope, and seeing a man dressed as a lightkeeper in front of the lighthouse. And the other thing that people have seen as they're entering the lighthouse and just starting to go up the stairs, they will see a 5-year-old girl coming down the stairs telling them not to go any further. They've also heard the antique phone that's in the lighthouse down at the very base of it ring while they're further on up the steps in the lighthouse. One person said that she actually was coming about halfway down. She had stopped on one of the landings to take a break. She had a thing with heights and needed to pause for a minute. They heard the phone ring, and they knew it was disconnected, so they were like, what's going on? So she sent her son down the rest of the way. There was nobody else on the way down, nobody else down below. He actually, tapped the bell to make it ring and asked, is that what you heard? She said, yes, it was. And he checked, and he made sure that it was disconnected. It shouldn't have been ringing. They just had it there so you could see what it looked like. But, again, beautiful, absolutely beautiful lighthouse to go to and great views when you're there. Now, next to it, there's actually a... a fort there known as Fort Screven. Fort Screven's been on the island for quite a while. Oops, I just forgot his island. So Fort Screven, it's actually really hard to find any stories about Fort Screven. When we visited, it was last a bunker during World War One. Was it used in World War II, do you remember?
I think so, yeah.
Yes, it was, yeah. So it's been a bunker that's been around for a while. So both major world wars,
oh, yeah.
And even before that. It actually,
there were Germans all over off the coast.
Yeah. And it has a fascinating museum in it, so definitely go check that out. It actually shows you what the Girl Scouts look like on the island as well, that were interacting with the soldiers and the lighthouse and all that. It ties a really nice story together. But the story that we have actually is from a police officer who joined the Tybee Island police force, and he was on patrol one night. So he actually said that he was doing his rounds and ended up parking at the Fort Screven building at about 3 o'clock in the morning, and he saw that there was a light kind of going around the building, and he thought this was odd. He didn't recall there being like a night watchman or anything along those lines at the fort, so he radioed back to his office and asked them, you know, hey, dispatch, do you guys know fort security? Have they added a night watchman? What do you, what should I be advised to do here?
That's from not soda. Oops.
That's how you fix that. And so he waited for them to come back, and he decided he was going to get up and go around and look to see what, you know, what could we find.
Don't mind me. I'm distracted. Sorry, everybody.
It's okay. He's distracting me. You know, what could he find? Could he see a person with this light just moving around? Well, after he'd come back from one direction, he noticed that his supervisor's car was parked next to his. And his supervisor basically had asked him, did you see anything? And he replied, no, I didn't see anything. He checked the vehicle, finding the vehicles there were locked and secure. He then asked, are you sure you didn't see anything, by the supervisor? And then the supervisor asked, did you just get spooked? And he said, no, I saw this light, and he explained what he had seen, and the supervisor said, this place is haunted. He said, okay, I'm going to go make one more loop around. He went around to the back side of the fort where there's another parking lot that you can actually access the beach from, and the supervisor was waiting for him when he got on that side with the car, and they were both secure. They were confirmed that the building was probably secure, but again, the supervisor said this place is so haunted, and then drove away. That is the only ghost story I have found about this place, and I know there's a weird energy inside that building.
Oh, it's a very fascinating story.
It is. I will go back there in a heartbeat and visit it again.
And nothing feels sinister about it.
No, but it's crammed with so much history inside there from various aspects of the island that I'd be surprised if there isn't something there. It's one thing I would love to take the team out on and go and investigate for the night.
I would love to be able to actually get in and see what the residences look like there.
Oh,
did
yes.
you mention those?
No, I didn't.
So this is, it's a very extensive fortification there. Parts of the fortification have actually been turned into residences.
The old barracks. Yeah.
And I mean, still the concrete structure. They've converted them into places for people to live. And it blends right in. It's seamless with everything else.
Oh, heck yeah. If we could rent one of those and, like, go spend a couple of nights out on Friday, I would be ecstatic.
Yeah. From the outside, it all looks the same, but there's a couple of them where it's like, oh, that's odd. There's a car garage there, and, oh, is that some patio furniture up there on that?
On the top of the building.
On, like, the battlement, if you were.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Kind of a very interesting location, and if the insides of those residences are anything like the inside of the museum, that's got to be a really kind of kind of trippy place to live.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, definitely. All right, so we're going to come back home to Virginia.
Yeah? Wait, what are you doing?
It's 9:19.
Oh, no, we got to do this.
Oh,
I promise.
You promise?
I promise, yes, I promise.
All right, so I found some more point lookout stories.
Yes.
Because we told a lot of them the last time we talked about point lookout.
We have to get this in, though. So, Glenn, yeah, we got our good friend Glenn. Yep, we mentioned Point Lookout Lighthouse. Glenn.
Which we did talk about with our lighthouse show, but we're going to come back to it.
Yes, yep, we are going to come back to it. We're going to come back, because, I mean, it's not just the lighthouse there. Point Lookout is now a state park up there in Maryland.
Yes, and it's a great place to camp. We love camping there. In fact, if we can book something for later this year or early next spring, I'd say let's go.
Yes. Just a little bit, if you didn't catch the last one that we did when we were talking about...
Yeah, so we talked about the lighthouse itself. It's open every first Friday of the month for tours. Check their schedule. They might be more open. At that point in time, they were still working on restoration, and they may be closer to being finished up, so it might be open more often.
Hopefully. But this is it's at a little point of land that sticks out in the state of Maryland, and it sticks out where the Potomac River meets the Chesapeake Bay. And so, as we mentioned, got a lighthouse there, but the site has an extensive history to it. It was used for thousands of years as a hunting and fishing ground by the Yakomiko tribe. Sorry if I butchered that. And the fur area was first sighted by Spanish explorers in 1500s. John Smith lands there in 1612. So some of the Europeans start coming in. It's one of the very first places that European settlers and European explorers stumble upon as they start exploring what became the American coast.
Yeah, what's a good place to draw in for a deep water port, those types of things. Civil War, it actually becomes a fortification and a POW camp.
Yes.
Which we talked about some of the hauntings of the POW camp the last time.
Yeah. And in the 1880s, developers came in and they built a resort and a hotel that people love because it's got nice cooling breezes in the area.
It's a great place to go crabbing, to go fishing. It's a wonderful place to go and explore.
Yeah. Great place to go check out. And it does have, because of its history, it's kind of a spotted history, and particularly the terrible prison of war camp that was there during the Civil War. It has numerous stories of hauntings. And so one of them is the Confederate Ghost at Point Lookout. So during the Civil War, it was federal forces that occupied Point Lookout, and including this prisoner of war camp and a hospital for the wounded, many of them coming in from the Battle of Gettysburg. A trip for some of these poor soldiers, they're suffering battle wounds. It was a long, arduous journey. The relative isolation of the area made escape attempts by Confederate prisoners for almost impossible. Back in that time, it's easy to get there today with the modern roads that they have there, but back then
it was a swampy man.
It's out there. So the Hammond General Hospital was designed with wards radiating out from a central hub, kind of like spokes on a wheel, and it was shut down shortly after the end of the Civil War. Camp Hoffman, the largest federal facility for Confederate prisoners, was built to contain 10,000 prisoners, but is believed by some to have held up to 50,000 men. Prisoners were held in an open-air camp in tattered canvas tents. Hot and mosquito-infested summer, freezing cold in the winter, conditions were crowded and dirty, and there were reports of contaminated water and spoiled food. A smallpox outbreak forced the establishment of a separate unit for infectious diseases. It is estimated that between 3,000 and 8,000 men died of war wounds and disease and were buried in a mass grave at the site. One of the most frequent ghostly sightings at Point Lookout is a man in Civil War era clothing. He is seen moving across the road away from what was once the smallpox unit. The gaunt ghost shambles across the road reeking of mildew and gunpowder, wearing ragged homespun clothing. It has been postulated that perhaps a Confederate prisoner feigned illness is hoping to escape, but as his ghost runs across the road repeatedly, it is doubtful that he succeeded in his escape attempt. This forlorn ghost seems to not notice the living, but perseveres on in his eternal path toward an elusive freedom. So as you go on, there's a lot.
There's a lot more sightings.
There's a lot of other sightings and hauntings out there as well.
So in the campground, we mentioned that there's a crossroads where there's a sighting that is seen, but I found another one. During the night, campers reported hearing unusual happenings. A group of teenagers were exploring the grounds with a flashlight and spotted a man dressed in Civil War era garb holding a bayonet. He paced back and forth inside of the lighthouse fence as if guarding it. A young woman who was enjoying the beach during the sunset before heading back to her tent observed a ghostly figure walking into the water and disappearing. Perhaps the most chilling of all stories was a camper who was sitting around a fire circle reported hearing voices around his campsite. Mm-hmm. A moment later, a cold gust ran through his chest, rendering him speechless. Most often, people hear footsteps and strange sounds in the middle of the night, which would most likely attribute to wild animals. However, walking, when you're out walking, boot prints can be found right outside of the tent. I know when we were out camping there, the first time we camped there, we were at a tent site that was just a tent site, and it was surrounded by bamboo. We were warned of the skunks and that we would probably hear them rustling outside of our tent. and I was like, oh, please don't. no skunks. And after that, we decided we didn't want to be in that area again, so we picked a site that's an RV site and set up our tent there, which is nice because it's right on the water and the breezes come through and help cool down the tent and that sort of thing. And we didn't hear any rustling of animals around us, which is better, and I was good with that. I did notice that somebody had mentioned something about Haunted Hawaii. We are going to have a Haunted Hawaii show coming up, probably in 3 weeks, I think is our time frame for that.
Roughly what we're looking at. We do have some of those Haunted Hawaii stories out there already. They were in...
Including Pounder's Beach. So we do have a beach for Hawaii out there.
Yes, but we talked about the palaces of Hawaii in our Haunted Palaces episode, part one.
Part one.
Yeah.
So, but we will have a completely just Hawaiian one because that's just a fantastic place to go and visit. I got to get Chris there.
Yes, I need to go there. I have not been there at all yet.
It's okay. I went when I was young, and it was part of the family business trip, so we booked a vacation with it since we were already going to be out there. And that's what you do. It saves money. All right, so we're going to jump to Virginia Beach now, close to home where we have a beach here in town. In town. So everybody from town goes. So I'm going to start with the Virginia Beach and Surf Rescue Museum because we had a life-saving station there as well. It still stands in Virginia Beach, and it is a museum that you can go to these days when it is open. It is a building that was built in 1903. The Virginia Beach and Surf Rescue Museum presents our Coastal History Maritime Museum through the exhibits on the local surfing legends and the superstorms that hit Virginia Beach. It also includes information about shipwrecks, local lifeguards, stations, and more. Many of the museum's staff, however, report experiencing otherworldly phenomena in the old building. Some have heard maniacal laughing attributed to the Witch of Pongo, Ray Sherwood, who is disembodied spirit. Also, disembodied spirits of shipwreck victims were often laid to rest in the attic of the building until the bodies were claimed, and even phantom footsteps that lead up to the guard's tower. Every time I've tried to go to this museum, it has been closed. I need to plan better. But it is one place I do want to go.
Hopefully we'll get there.
Yes, and I do want to get out to the lighthouse out there as well.
We can make a day trip of that.
We could. First Landing State Park is a state park out there, and that's another place I want to go. A friend of mine has camped out there, but it's one place I would love to go and explore.
They have a lighthouse.
They have a lighthouse, although the lighthouse, I will tell you right now, is on a fort. So you have to make sure you have your registration and all of that fun stuff to go onto the fort to be able to go to the lighthouse. And make sure you go on the right road so you don't meet the gentleman with the AK-47s who are used to people saying, I took the wrong road.
We don't know guns too well, so we know it's not AK-47s. You don't need to correct us. It's okay.
They're big guns.
Yes.
That's all I have to say. Anyway.
Moving on.
They're very nice at that stuff because they're used to people taking the wrong road. But anyway, moving on. So in the early 1700s, the shores of the Chesapeake Bay were home to fearsome pirates. Sound familiar? Including the most famous pirate of all. Teach.
Yes, Blackbeard again.
So he often would come up in this era, and he would be basically looking for places to either hide his treasure, or he'd be looking for the merchant ships that are coming up in this area that are heavily laden, ready to go in. So they're good, and he would get more treasure. So the saying or the story goes that after sacking a particularly bountiful merchant ship, the Navy was spotted coming from the west, and Teach's men had to basically hide their prize. After burying the treasure in the dunes of the beach, the men fled through the narrow inland waterways of the park, back out into the ocean before sailing to their hideout down in Ocracoke. They intended to reclaim the gold when it was clear of the naval warship. That was never to be, however, because the Navy caught up the Teach off of the North Carolina coast, as we have previously talked about, and he ended up beheaded. So it is said that he at some time seen actually up in this area trying to find his lost treasure. He wants to protect it because he held it very dear. So either he's finding it or he's scaring you away from it so you don't find it. Yeah, that's it. Double checking my notes.
Here, have more to drink.
I might pass up soon.
We got one more story for you this evening.
Oh, it's the last one. Okay.
Yeah, it's the last one. Sadly, I feel like we got more drinking and talking to do.
Well, we skipped a few stories, too, because I noticed we were running long, and I'm like, oh, we need to scoot ahead. We'll come back to beaches another day.
Oh, there will be plenty of beach talk.
Because we got to go Maine, because Maine's got some stuff.
Yes.
So.
Not necessarily beaches that you go swim at, but
the beaches.
Beautiful beachfront. Maybe we could call it beach towns or something like that. Yeah, kind of the coastal towns.
Coastal towns.
Yes. Places with beaches, but not necessarily ghost stories right on the beaches.
Yeah. All right, so continue.
This isn't really all right on the beach. This is the Cavalier Hotel.
Which is in Virginia Beach.
Which is in Virginia Beach. So, yeah, not necessarily we're talking on the beach, but the Cavalier Hotel. So it has a very intricate history, and ghosts are naturally said to have been spotted by many of the people who have walked through the Cavalier Hotel's grand lobby. The piano in the opulent crystal ballroom would play with no one seated at it, and a long-lost cat could be heard scratching and meowing at guest room doors. A kind old bellman had on occasion been seen on the stairs leading from the fifth floor to the sixth floor, warning of ghosts ahead, only to vanish when guests turned to question him. Even famed brewer Adolf Coors, yes, that Coors beer,
yep.
Whose lifeless body was found below his sixth-story window in 1929, if you didn't know that fun fact, there you go, had been spotted walking the corridors in the dead of the night. Cavalier Hotel, it's a very ritzy place built in 1927, and it's been frequented by, well, not just famous brewers, but also people as prevalent as, well, Al Capone, all the way to President Woodrow Wilson. So you got all ends of the spectrum here. Said that a previous owner of the hotel had even shot himself there, adding more to the kind of ghastly history of sometimes ghastly history of the place. And if you want a good haunted hotel with this close proximity to a beach,
yep,
got one
the
right down the road here.
A lot of people just say it is a creepy ass hotel. We have never stayed down in Virginia Beach, so we visit it, but we usually do a day trip.
It's fairly close.
Yeah, so we go down early in the morning. By noontime, we are off the beach, and I am trying to hide from the sun as much as possible because I'm a vampire. I noticed Terry asked, what is this up here? I'm assuming this is what she's talking about. This is Figment. Figment just lives up here, and he inspires our imagination. He is the Figment from Disney, so I hope that's what Terry is responding to.
What is that thing on the map? Between the bottle
and
the picture.
So I'm assuming it's Figment.
Figment, we had him out.
They had him out for Haunted Highways.
Haunted Highways, part one.
Figment
from Disney. Because we were talking about the I-4 down
and
in.
And Disney helped convince the owner of the property to sell. Because he knew the area was going to get very popular.
Yep.
And the I-4 is the road that leads to Disney.
Yep. So,
Figment. Other questions?
Let's see. Glad to hear tonight has a sequel. Yeah, we're more than happy to talk about that.
Yeah.
Jeff was at First Landing just today.
Oh, wonderful.
Beautiful and creepy. Lots of folklore in that area.
Yeah.
Absolutely so. We might wind up revisiting First Landing at some point because there is so much there to talk about.
Yeah.
And Allison, yep, can't not talk about the Cavalier. Yep.
And we also talk Long Allison. It's a disease in this company.
Yep.
We all like to talk. We don't like to shut up about ghost stories.
Yep. Let's see. Sarah mentioned Teach Blackbeard also had a house in Beaufort called the Hammock House where he hung one of his wives. I just bounced around. Where'd it go? In the tree in the backyard.
Ooh. Okay, I need to look up Beaufort to go. I have friends who go there last summer.
Thank you for sharing that, Sarah. That is.
I need to look that up.
We love these little tidbits. Thank you for sharing these with us.
Give us things the research.
Did the recent renovations at the Cavalier cause a resurgence of ghost activity?
From what I was able to find online, nothing talked about the recent post-renovations. They talked about that it was under renovation, so that was all a little bit dated, but it definitely would be something I would, again, be cool to go talk to the staff and maybe get an investigation group in there.
If they allow it, yeah.
If they allow it.
Yeah. Worth checking into that. And Glenn says he's heard that Cape May has ghost hauntings and sites. So
I have heard that Cape May is quite haunted. I just have not dove down that rabbit hole yet.
Might wind up in Haunted Beaches, Beach Towns, Volume 2.
Yes.
Let's see. On a trip tips, always
and
appreciated.
I should talk about Augustine at some point, too.
Yep. Oh, and Allison's got to go. Bye, Allison, if you're not gone already. But, those are our stories for this evening.
So we're going to take another road trip next week.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, we're going to do another Haunted Highways, and we're going to focus on the northern part of the U.S., Massachusetts, upward, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts,
Maine, I think, yeah.
Did we have any in New York? I don't think so.
I thought Long Island.
Oh, yes, Long Island.
Yeah.
We do have a couple in New York. So we're going to focus on the northeast quarter of the U.S. for some more haunted highways. And these are more of routes and local roads versus, like, major highways like we did last time. So it'll be interesting to kind of see some of these. Some of these are colonial roads. The one in New York is actually a colonial road. And it's considered extremely haunted. So I can't wait to share those stories with you. Because we're all itching to get out on the road and travel and do fun stuff when it is safe to do so.
And Allison says, remind me to tell you about Southport. Isn't Southport one of the stories that we got for next week? I think it might be, Allison, but we will bring it up with you.
Yeah, I'll have to look.
So with that, take a moment for our shameless plugs.
Yes, gift cards.
Gift cards. Yeah, if you're interested in getting gift cards, we are hoping to be open for tours sooner than later.
Yeah, hopefully the 12th.
We'll think. Let's not put a date on it yet. We just jinxed it. Just knock on wood or something. Anyways,
antique wood.
But we're hoping to be open for tours sooner than wood.
Rub the Irish cap for luck.
Yeah.
So hopefully soon we have been monitoring the situation, and it seems that some entertainment rules have been slightly relaxed, but we're waiting for, again, confirmation and clarity because some things just disappeared all of a sudden.
Yeah.
And we're like, what happened?
We'll figure it out.
So as soon as we know, we will open. But, again, go ahead and purchase the gift card. It's good for both companies, both the History Tour and the Ghost Tour. We are not going to close this. This is my full-time job. I'm not going back to a classroom. This is what I do. So I will take you out on a tour when they say I can take you out on a tour.
Yep. And the other thing is, in the meantime, on the history side of things,
yep.
Our
Richmond Historic Haunts.
It's actually, we've been on these video feeds. We've been checking in at Richmond Historic Haunts, Haunts of Richmond, checking in at Richmond Historic Haunts. So Richmond Historic Haunts, we consider it our home.
Yeah.
And so the Richmond Historic Haunts name, we have actually launched our first digital self-guided tour. It's a digital version, self-guided version of our Rails and Sails history tour.
Mm-hmm.
And it's offered, unfortunately, this is one thing that you can't use a gift card on because we were working with an app called Built Story.
Yeah.
So if you look up story, you can you should be able to find our Rails and Sails history tour on there. And
it is $10, but if you're a first-time user to Built Story, your first tour is free.
Yep, your first Built Story tour is free. So if you've never used it before, you can go ahead, you can get it for free. And if you have used it before, it's only $10.
Yep.
And
we will be adding another tour soon for our history one, and actually in the next 2 weeks, I'm actually going to start researching our first ghost tour
for this.
So hopefully we will have a ghosty one soon.
Yep.
Again, it's not going to be a walking tour. It's going to be a driving tour. It's going to be a little longer than our walking tours, but that's why it took me a bit to research it, to figure out where's a good stopping point that's safe. So definitely check that out. Go on out. At least this way we can take you out on a tour virtually, if not in real life.
Yep.
Until
we can do it in real life. So with that, I think that's all the shameless plugging that I had to do for this evening.
Yes. Enjoy your dark and stormy folks.
Yes. Cheers, everybody. Again, hope you had a good, great Memorial Day weekend.
We'll see you next Monday.
Yeah, we'll see you next Monday. And again, thanks again to all of our veterans for their service. And thank you all for tuning in again for this week. So
cheers.
Cheers.
Have a good night. Be safe.
Have a good night. Bye, everybody.
I mean about future calamity. I used to think the idea was obsolete until I heard the old man stamping his feet.